During the last few months, we have been looking into an age-old teaching that the ultimate is realized through denuding the mind of all concepts, ideas, beliefs, and so on. It is a process of liberation into the unconditioned state. That is to say, it is the mind which finds complete freedom in the unconditioned state. We as living beings in the world of affairs, physically, of course, can never know anything like a completely unconditioned state. But the mind can be released into the state where there is no conditioning whatsoever. Therefore, the mind is utterly luminous, utterly transparent.
What is this?
And in that state, there is the awareness which is the transcendent awareness. An awareness which is not known whilst it is being experienced. It is only afterwards that memory will reconstruct the experiencing of the infinite in finite terms. Terms which of necessity will take the forms with which we were already familiar. Now you will find in various Upanishads, just as in Genesis, and in the Rig Veda, and in the other scriptures, there are statements about the beginning of things, about the creation of the world. I'd like to read to you just this little bit here, illustrating how the Subbala Upanishad presents the matter. He discoursed on that, and he asked the question, what was there then? To him, that is to Subbala, he, Brahma, God the Father, gives the answer. It was not existent, nor not non-existent, neither existent and non-existent. From that emerged darkness. From darkness, the subtle elements. From the subtle elements, akasha, space or the sky or the firmament, whichever translation you like. From the firmament, air. From air, fire. From fire, water. From water, earth. Then there came into being the egg. That egg, after incubation for a year, split in two, the lower one being the earth and the upper one being the sky. Yes, he uses the word akasha for that, which you can also translate as firmament or heaven.
You men can load up on the wagon over there.
You see the similarity to Genesis in this latter part. But when he begins, he says, then was there neither existent nor non-existent. And you get the same in the Rig Veda. Now you may remember, I mentioned that all that in all the scriptures, wherever you find, in the beginning, it refers to the individual himself in the state of the transcendent awareness. That is the beginning. Returning back from that transcendent awareness into the ordinary consciousness of everyday life, there is a certain order in which things appear in the mind. This is the creation of the world. But the order, the forms in which things appear in the mind are forms which are already known to the person. You can't avoid it. The conceptions of the world, the nature of things, are conceptions which are put into our minds from infancy onwards. They represent the knowledge of the world in worldly terms, the knowledge of man's nature and mind in ordinary worldly psychological terms. So this will form the stuff of the mind, so to say, which is already in the person's brain. Negating all these, one realizes transcendent awareness. But when one comes back, one has no other material than the forms already present. But there is a difference. In the coming back, a certain amount of purification, a certain amount of clearer, more lucid, truer expression comes into being. But a really great purification, really great clarification can only come through the centuries with the growth of our worldly knowledge of the nature of things. Our scientific knowledge, as we may call it. See, in the old days, they said that the world was made of fire, air, earth, water, and ether. They postulated these elements. These are the only words they knew. These were the only conceptions they had. Therefore, a person in transcendent awareness, coming back to ordinary consciousness, could naturally talk only in terms of fire, air, earth, water. He couldn't escape that limitation. As the thousands of years, not merely centuries, as the thousands of years have passed, we have obtained deeper, more accurate, more inclusive knowledge about the nature of things. We have developed to a much greater extent our knowledge of the nature of the psyche and the way it functions and so forth. Therefore, today, if a person were to enter into this sort of state of consciousness and then come back, the forms which would appear in his mind representing the nature of the world would be that much more in advance of the forms of 20 and 30 centuries ago. Today he wouldn't talk in terms of fire, air, earth, water. He would talk in terms of oxygen, hydrogen, carbon, and so on. Wouldn't he? Now this has to be very clearly understood. So much from the purely material side. There is also the symbolical side. To these old people, the elements did not mean merely the physical elements as such, but they always invented correspondences with psychical conditions and states and with states of consciousness. See, for instance, in theistic religions, when we talk, for instance, of the Holy Spirit, but spirit, pneuma, is breath. air. Is it not? It was the same with the Upanishadic teachers. Prana, life, is also physically breath, the air which we breathe. And prana is a word which applies transcendentally to the absolute, to the ultimate reality. In the Chandogya Upanishad, you have Brahman is prana, Brahman is life, Brahman is joy, Brahman is the infinite. That's how it's put in three forms in the Chandogya, which is one of the two largest, greatest of the Upanishads, you see. So, they had a symbolical meaning also for physical terms. Earth, air, fire, water stood for increasing or decreasing states of consciousness. Increasing or decreasing in refinement, in subtlety, in subtlety. See, that's how they put it. So this creation of the world is the reappearance in a man's mind on returning from that state of transcendent awareness, which is represented by in the beginning or by the word then. Now you see, the journey to the state of transcendent awareness is a journey wherein all this is negated, step by step. Now I want to read you just this paragraph here, which is the end of that Upanishad, the Subala Upanishad. Now here another sage asks the question. Then Raikva asked, "Venerable sir, how and by what means does this which is a mass of intelligence, this deep state of consciousness which is just a mass of intelligence, after moving upwards, burn away its seat?" Now, let us be quite clear what this sentence means. When we are walking about or doing physical things, our consciousness is rooted in the body, isn't it? It is rooted in the physical world. We are very conscious of everything physical, including the body. Supposing you're a sculptor and you're making sculpting a bronze head or whatever it is, see? Well, you're very conscious of that bronze, you're very conscious of your own hands and so forth. The intelligence has its root, its seat, as they say here, its seat in the body, see? Now the question which is asked is this: how and by what means does this, which is a mass of intelligence, after moving upwards, meaning into the profounder states of consciousness, burn away that in which it is rooted already? See? So it is going to burn away the material world, the intellectual world, etc., etc. Now notice what the answer is. To him he replied thus: "This Atma, after moving upwards, burns." There is a list of Sanskrit names which stand for what are commonly called the vital airs. You see, prana, apana, udana, samana, and so forth. Perhaps it would be simplest if we just regarded them as representing different aspects of our own life, from a grosser to a more refined, subtler state. It will be sufficient for our purpose to regard it that way for the moment. It burns earth, water, fire, air, and ether. It burns. The term burn is used in to suggest the complete liberation from. That which is burnt is gone forever, isn't it? That's the end of it. They couldn't conceive of a more complete end than by burning the thing up. That is the ultimate end. Today, of course, we would give it a hydrogen bomb explosion in order to give it a still more complete end. It burns the waking, dreaming, and sleeping states, as also the Turiya, the fourth, or the transcendent state. It gets rid of everything. You see the process of negating. In the dreaming state, you are entering into your own inner world. In the waking state, you are conscious of the external world and everything external. In the dreaming state, you utilize the experience of the physical world and think about it and ponder upon it and so forth. You enter into a realm of imagination. This is the dreaming state. A dream is an imagination, after all, isn't it? And so forth. Then you enter the deep sleep state, which is the state of intense abstract awareness, abstract consciousness, getting right away from things material, so to say. Just like a mathematician who is absolutely absorbed in a very abstruse mathematical problem. He's right away from ordinary material things and ordinary sensuous things and so forth. Alright? And then, beyond that, finally, the transcendent state where none of these are. All these are burnt away. This mighty world and the other world is burnt away. The yonder world, meaning the world of the profound states of consciousness. It burns the visible and the invisible worlds. It burns virtuous and vicious conduct. Thereafter, it burns the world devoid of luster, devoid of limit, devoid of appearance. In other words, the unmanifest condition, so to say. It burns the unmanifested, as he says here. It burns the imperishable. Now you see, when we think, we use terms like unmanifest, imperishable, eternal, etc. And yet when we use such words, if you will look deeply into the mind as we are talking or thinking about these things, the mind will form limited concepts. The imperishable. Look at the use of the definite article. How can you use a definite article excepting for the fact that the mind is incorrigibly entrenched in this habit of limiting, defining, making a thing of it? You can't make a thing of infinity. You see how I escaped the trap of saying the infinite by saying infinity. You see the point? All right. So, this mass of intelligence gets right away from all these concepts, however subtle, however deep-seated they are. And if you meditate on this sort of thing, in using the terms unmanifested and imperishable, all that we call the archetypal forms and so forth, they are all included in them. It burns away. It's rather interesting that this Upanishad should use the word burn. One is reminded of Moses and the burning bush. The bush is all this universe. Not only the material, not merely the material universe. In fact, nothing burns the material universe as such, but as it is in the mind. Everything is burnt up. This is the burning bush, if you like. Where one's profoundest thoughts, one's most sublime conceptions, one's fulfilled deepest aspirations, what one seems to have realized as unshakable truth, all that is burnt away. You see? Now look at his last statement. It burns death. This is something really tremendous. I haven't come across it anywhere else in any scripture. Death becomes one with the radiant supreme. So you see the implication. The realization of the supreme means a process of negation, a process of burning away, which is a process of death, if you please, until in finality death itself is burnt away. And this statement, death becomes one with the radiance supreme, means that there is no annihilation, therefore. We'll go back to that very first little section. I'll go on from where I stopped. We stopped at the egg, which after incubation for a year split in two, the lower one being the earth, the upper one being the sky. In the middle, between the two parts, there came into being the divine person. The person with 1,000 heads, 1,000 eyes, 1,000 feet and 1,000 arms. In the middle, between the earth and the sky, between the earth and the heaven, came into being the divine person. This is how they put it. We have to understand it, what it implies, what it means. Those who talk in terms of astrological symbolism, Plato and Pythagoras both accepted this, really. It is the zodiac, which is the heavenly man. You know, the zodiacal signs are associated with the different parts of the body. Aries, the head, Taurus, the throat, Gemini, the chest and arms, you see. Cancer, the heart and tummy. No, I beg your pardon. Cancer, the lungs. Leo, the heart. Virgo, the stomach. And so forth. Right down to Pisces with the feet. 12 signs of them. This is the heavenly man. The zodiac which surrounds our solar system. They had their own symbolism of the divine person. I better not digress into what Plato and Pythagoras say about it. It's all put in very lovely and beautiful forms. But we must go on. Now, this person, this divine person, created death, the foremost of all beings, the three-eyed, three-headed, and three-footed one. The name given in the Sanskrit is Khandaparashu. Interesting, isn't it? The thousand-eyed, thousand-headed one creates the three-eyed, the three-footed, the three-headed one. Death. Of him, this divine person, Brahma, became afraid. The death got hold of Brahma alone. Thereupon, Brahma created 7 sons out of his mind. These created in their turn, out of their minds, 7 sons filled with truth. These are verily the Prajapatis, the lords of creation. Genesis, the different patriarchs, the line of the patriarchs. You'll find this tradition in all the scriptures of the world, and it's put in this form, sevens or tens. Those are the usual numbers for the progenitors of mankind, the lords of creation, as they are called. We needn't go into all that. That doesn't concern us at the moment. But I read that in order to bring out this point about death, that the divine person created death. And death got hold of the divine person, whereupon the divine person creates 7 mind-born sons. You will find in Thrice Greatest Hermes similar teachings. These are all symbolical ways of talking. Perhaps to put it in a sentence, the most important significance of all these different sons of God and so forth which are created is simply the big archetypal forces which govern our lives. We are ruled by the archetypal concepts, whether we are conscious of them or not, whether we ever hear about them in our lives or not. But you see, the mind of each individual person inherits this somehow. In a peculiar way, he inherits it all. It is there. And it functions without his knowing it. Well, our bodily functioning is also very largely without our knowing it, isn't it? What do we know about the functioning of the living body? But it functions. And it continues to live, and so forth. All right. So now, death becomes one with the radiant Supreme and the ultimate. Therefore, the fruition of the religious life is wholeness, completeness. That is the fruition. Holiness. We have to appreciate this point not merely with the mind, with the brain. We have to sort of appreciate it with our total being. That the fruition of the religious life is the realization of holiness, of wholeness. Which implies a purification through the denudation of the mind, of all its beliefs, conclusions, and all the rest of it. Ideas, perceptions, misperceptions, and everything. See, the function of the mind is impaired because we cling to fixed ideas. The ideas may well correspond with reality. That need not be denied. But we take the form, we take the mental form, which is a dead thing, a fossil, and cling to that form. And whilst we cling to that form, we cannot be aware in a living sense of the truth of existence. That is the point. The dead form obstructs the living awareness. The idea may be true, that is to say, it may correspond to what was a living experience, granted. But we don't need to cling to any ideas or beliefs or anything at all. The living person constantly throws out ideas. They are expressions. They are outthrowings pressed out of us. Therefore, don't cling to them. If we don't cling to them, then we truly live. And we live in terms more approximating to wholeness, to completeness, to holiness. Now this is very difficult. Even granting that you are completely in agreement with what has been said. Well, all right, we may be completely in agreement, but have we got the capacity to do it? This is the problem. The capacity to do it. We may accept the idea as just propounded, but merely accepting the idea as propounded, although a necessary step, if you like, does not mean that one has realized truth. One has fulfilled religious living. It doesn't mean that. Now we can help by meditation in the real sense. Meditation in the real sense is not a case of going through the motions in the mind, which is just a mumbling of words. See, when we are told, meditate upon such and such a subject, all that we do is go through a series of words in association with the subject of meditation. Well, what's happened? We've done a lot of internal talking, and at the end of it, we will shoot the deer and enjoy some venison. That is all we'll do. We are no nearer wholeness than we were before. Sunday is for church, the other day is for not church. That's how we are. Now, last time, you remember we did a little meditation, letting the body become perfectly restful. Perfectly at peace, quiet. And you remember how, after the preliminary condition of peace, there was the tendency, all may not have gone through it, but some may have, are sure to have gone through it. After that preliminary state of peace, a turmoil from inside, from deep inside, comes to the surface. And this turmoil is due to the uprising of all the incompleted, unfinished things in the mind. The frustrations, the repressions, the resentments, the confusions, they all start tumbling out. Tumbling up. It's a wonderful way to tumble. And so, there is a disturbance. And as a result of that, we immediately feel shocked and upset. Oh, my goodness, now what's wrong? It was going so nicely, and then the whole thing just got spoiled. And then you remember afterwards, we spent a few minutes upon trying to see to what extent we are dominated by the God idea. We took just one idea, with which our minds are all full, the God conception, and we chose the God conception, you remember, for the very simple reason that every one of us was born in a theistic culture. it's only some Hindus, not all Hindus, some Hindus, and of course the Buddhists, who are born in a non-theistic culture. So to them, the God concept hasn't got such a binding influence. It's just a superficial thing in their minds, because they are not powerfully conditioned by the God idea. We are, every one of us here. You see? And you remember I suggested that for the fortnight till today, we sort of investigate to what extent this God concept dominates our lives. Now, how successful were you with the investigation? Was there any investigation? And what happened in consequence?
I realized, well, I tended not to be interested in God and have anything to do with belief in God. This was constantly in my mind, and I was obviously still thinking of God and pushing the idea further and further. It's still there all the time, even though I had, as it were, given up the idea of God. I found this for some time now.
The important question which we should pursue is this. When we say give up the idea, what exactly is implied in that? You see, let me put it this way. Supposing I live in a house where the atmosphere is terribly polluted. There are factories around pouring, their chimneys pouring smoke all day and all night and whatnot, you see. And so the air is very much polluted, fumes and this, that and the other. Now, how do I give up this atmosphere which I have been breathing all the time? I can't just say, oh, I give up the atmosphere. I can't blow it aside. Haven't got the power to do that. Now, it's the same with an idea. We say, give up an idea. But just what does it mean?
It seems to be the reverse process. The idea, whether the idea will give up you or not, rather than somebody giving up the idea.
It seems to me there is also an element of conditioning here. That if this idea has been dimmed into your head since you were that high, it's going to be a bit difficult to get rid of.
Now this is the important thing. How is one to be free of it? Remember something which we have stressed again and again. Where our ideas, thoughts, feelings and so forth are concerned, those very feelings, thoughts, and so forth are the psyche, are the me. It is not like an old handkerchief in my pocket which I just take out and put into the washing basket. It's not like that. It's part and parcel of my actual constitution. I can't take out part and parcel of my actual constitution and throw it away, get rid of it. This is the trouble, where giving up an idea or a belief is concerned.
But one disperses the something to something more spiritual.
No, how do you disperse it? This is the point.
Well, you get word from saying, God is a spirit. You know, worship him in spirit. Well, you think of the spirit as being something, idea, the mind, you know, nothing material at all. When you use the word God, as we all taught as we're small, you can't help but think of a person. Nice old dear with an old beard and white gown up in the sky. But when you get some sort of idea of thinking at all, you can think of the God as spirit, not God exactly, but the great power as a spirit, which is nothing material at all. You can't make real concept of it.
Yes, all you are doing is using your imagination in a different way.
So, yes.
But that doesn't free you from the domination of the God concept.
But how does one make one's mind blank?
Ah.
That's the thing.
You can't. You see, it's very interesting. What has been suggested so far has been characterized by the element of conflict. Hmm. Get rid of this. Disperse it.
Hmm.
Throw it out. You can't do that.
That rather than trying to get rid of the God concept you have, you leave it where it is and remove yourself from it.
Oh, but this is another form of conflict. No, no, you're only putting it the reverse way. Mm-hmm. Well, how can you remove yourself? I'm telling you, it is you yourself. The concept, the belief, the idea is the psyche of this living person. That's what constitutes the psyche. Otherwise, there is no constitution of the psyche as such.
Yes, but somehow, if you sort of look at the concept that you have,
you will change it into another concept.
Well, it seems to slide away somehow. Whether it slides.
No, if you say slide away, that means the attention has gone away from it, that you're not attending to it anymore.
It's more as if you sort of see it in the round.
And therefore?
Well, the only way I think of describing it is to say that you sort of stood back from it and looked at it.
Yes, all right. We stand back and look at it. That is to say, a bit of me is standing back and looking at another bit of me.
Yes.
All right. Then what happens?
Then nothing happens.
We are on square one. Yeah. That's, you see, this is the point.
My gardener, Hans Beek, I mean, I'm a jobbing gardener, a very nice man, he said to me, we were talking the other day, and he said, I don't know what to do to be good, to do so. He's such a nice man. I could have said, I think I'm Oscar Baber, just go on as you're going. Don't think about it. Just as you live as kindly and as well as you can, in the sense of being useful to yourself and other people too. Is that better there, more what we ought to do?
No, you see, Mrs. Perry, that is another issue.
Mm-hmm.
We are concerned at the moment with this question of freedom from our concepts.
But that isn't a concept, is it, there?
No, that's why I say it's another issue. The gardener wanting to be good or live the good life, you see, doesn't know what to do about it and so forth.
Yeah.
That is quite another issue.
Mm.
Let us deal with what we are doing, you see.
We're talking here about obsessions, aren't we? Being obsessed with our
eyes. Any concept or belief which we hold, cling to, is an obsession, yes, of course.
Yeah.
All right, now, how does one become free of the obsession?
Can I just ask a question? Is it a question of getting rid of the idea of the concept of God or various imaginings or feelings or thoughts or conceptions or whatever? Is it a question of God, the concept of God on the one hand, or
the accretion of things we've acquired over the centuries and millennia.
What is the concept itself but the accretions over the millennia? Can you separate the two?
This is fine. This is just what I want to find out. So therefore, in fact, I would assume that the... Is it... begs the question, is it desirable to get to separate contract from it?
What do you mean by desirable?
What?
Look, the question is, how does one realize freedom from the concept? From the domination by the concept.
I should speak with a very simple answer here, but I can't get the words. Because I cannot see one separating oneself from oneself. This is the point. This is part of one, indivisible, a whole. Therefore, if one has to free oneself from these. Overtone, ideas, concepts, then one must, as we said, look at them, recognize them for what they are, and I don't want to categorize them, but give them relativity to oneself in terms of one's daily life, that is, they make them relative to life without succumbing to them.
But you still got the whole lot of concepts in the bag.
I think don't think about it at all. Just go on appreciating the sound of the wisdom and the trees and nature in general. I don't say how you can get a blank mind. Don't tell people.
I think that trying to put it out of your mind is like trying to sweep the dirt under the rug. Nobody sees it, but it's still there.
Try to put it under the rug.
No, this is the important thing, isn't it? Now look. I have asked this question and wanted you to speak so as to stir up the situation, you see? Stir up the situation. In stirring up the situation, one begins to be more aware of the actual fact that our minds are in a state of confusion and not of clarity. You see? Now, as happens in all debating societies or question-answer meetings, one wants an answer in so many words about it. Now, I suggest that any answer I give in words will only raise up further concepts for the moment. You see? Therefore, let us spend some time in actual meditation about this, you see. Let us spend a few minutes in actual meditation. We'll use the same subject as we did last time, since we don't seem to have got very much further with it.
In this sense, do you mean thought, meditation,
as thought? No, look. Thank you for raising that up. That's very important. Meditation as a process of thinking, or musing, deliberate musing, is merely writing essays in imagination. That's no use. That's churning up the ocean of words as usual. And the only ocean of words that we have at our command is the ocean which represents all our concepts and beliefs. It's merely like turning a kaleidoscope round and round and round, that's all. And the same old stuff inside forms new patterns with which we are delighted. See, it's not that, no. Meditation, in this context, means take the word itself, you see, take the word itself, and or, as you please, whatsoever images that word conjures up. whatsoever other ideas, associated ideas, that image, that word conjures up. You see, for instance, you'll say, God the Father, God is love, God the Almighty, or whatever terms you like, you see. All right, take any one or two. Don't try to take the whole lot, otherwise we just get indigestion. You see, take any one. Let it be in front of your mind's eye, so to say. And see what it says to you. That is one aspect of it. And as it says this, that and the other to you, just don't grasp it. Don't say, oh, I've got a good idea. Or, oh, I'm getting at the truth. We are doing nothing of the sort. You see? Just keep looking at it. And see if we can become aware of an actual change in the mind itself as an organ, as an organism, a living thing. Something like this. Physically we know that if we have an awful tummy ache, we are in that state. The organism is in that state. And if it takes the right medicine or the sheer passage of time and the tummy ache disappears, then we feel different, don't we? The body is in a different state. Now the mind will be like that. All ideas, beliefs are like so many aches in the mind. They are obstructions in the mind. And as and when they disappear, you will become aware of the difference in the mind itself. Now just let's try and see. See, this is the absolute sort of ABC, the kindergarten stage of how to meditate. Meditating as an actual doing of something. Otherwise we just go on, you know, mumbling words, going through the motions. Fill your mind with metta or karuna or loving kindness or this, that, nothing happens. All right. Let's. Thank you. Now, what happened? Were you aware of the trance? Did it have any process? Or was it just a state of complete restfulness?
Maybe it was just a state of complete restfulness, but I reached a point where I was afraid that everyone in the room would disappear.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. But why were you afraid that everyone would disappear? Did it strike you why? You just were aware in terms of afraid everyone would disappear.
Yes.
You see, we have to remember this. When we say, in the usual way, that we know that so-and-so is sitting there or standing there, what we know is the impression, the image in our mind, which we describe as that person sitting there or standing there. We are convinced that the living person is there, and we are rightly convinced that the living person is there. You can touch him, you can talk to him, etc., etc. But what we are actually cognizant of is our mental image of the person all the time. So now, when you try to hold the God image in front of you and look, and you say you went off into a light trance, and you felt a fear that everyone would disappear, those images were going to disappear, which would have been an excellent thing.
Hell.
Obviously. Because look, the images we hold in our mind are nowhere near true to the thing in itself, or the person in himself or herself. Nowhere near. This is what the great religious teachers meant by saying we are in a state of delusion, of illusion. We just form pleasant pictures, what we would like them to be. I'd like my wife or son or friend or whoever it is to be thus and thus and thus, and I jolly well see to it that the image in my mind corresponds to what I like. It's only hard experience of the fact that makes me see otherwise. Isn't that so?
Yes.
All right, so what was going to disappear was the image. And that might have been an excellent thing, if you let it go. See, this is really very good. I mean, this is just what is wanted. This mass of intelligence burns away all the conceptions, all the false images. Just as we have images of the imperishable, the unmanifested, of God. That's what I'm trying to get at, you see.
Isn't it perhaps a fear of what might rush in when the images have disappeared
that makes us afraid? Don't be afraid, because things will rush in any case. New images. It's the nature of the living mind to be like that. This is what actually happens, yes.
We all disappear.
Pardon?
We all disappear, but we are God. We become God.
Ah, indeed. Put it in perhaps a truer way, that the transcendent real functions unobstructedly through you, or less obstructedly, when the images have disappeared. This is the point. But first, let's get at what
I find it extraordinarily difficult to meditate in a vacuum unless I have a concept, the word.
Yes.
I mean, one starts with the word, and that is a concept in itself. And one can only, at least I, can only follow it up in any real sense at all by using other words, mental words, thinking of that. And so this becomes quite useless.
You see, this is the point.
Negative result. I push everything out of my mind except the thought and the feeling of God. At this stage, you mean nothing. Nothing comes over to
me. You see, just as the body remains quiet, you see, but it's very much alive, and in fact it is much more happily and healthily alive when it is in perfect repose, isn't it? You see, in the same way, the mind in perfect repose is very much nearer the reality of intelligence functioning. This is a point which all our upbringing and education all over the world has robbed us of. The mind is unable to be quiet, to be restful. Look at dreams, for instance. We can't let the mind be at peace, in other words. Now you see, this getting a series of ideas, new words, new thoughts, in association with the word with which we started, God, is not meditation in the deep sense at all. You see, when one is in communion, in the real sense, then one is at peace. There is quietness. And it is the quietness which is the real sign that the meditation is meditation. Afterwards, when you have finished with it, mental shapes, that is thoughts, will emerge. And you will find that those shapes are far more clear and true than the previous shapes. Also, they will bind you less. Take this fact. The way we are conditioned with the God idea acts primarily in our young years as a terrible censor. Oh, mustn't do that. God wouldn't like it. He'll punish you or anything like that. God is the great censor. He is the great frustrator. Also, he is the lollipop giver, if you are good. But you see the absurdity of the situation. The transcendent is just reduced right down to our own beastly level. Not human level, but to a beastly level.
What have I done? You shouldn't punish me like this sort of idea.
This is the important thing. This is why the concept is such a nuisance. The concept God is a great frustrator, because all our concepts express ignorance, express misperception. Let the word be uttered, if you like, to stand for the indescribable, the unthinkable. It's all right. Let the sound be made because the person somehow or other, in that split second, or several seconds as the case may be, is in complete communion with the infinite. Then it has meaning, significance.
Yes. Supposing one doesn't have any ideas whatsoever, simply a blank mind, but they are conscious of noises outside, but it doesn't worry them. What is that?
That's exactly what happens in the
acute. That certainly is a meditative state. But it does not fulfill the particular purpose with which we set out to examine this God concept and see what it conjures up for us. Examine it. See the concept. See how the God idea through our own life has affected our life and conduct.
But how can you do that without words?
That you can't do without words, yes. But at the same time, you can observe it in a state of complete quiescence inside.
Then it is nothing, absolutely nothing. If it's without words, it has no meaning at all.
It may be the other way around, that the words hide the real meaning. Meaning in the sense of living significance. As a living power. Yes?
Well, I was going to say that I think at a rather early age I sort of rebelled at this concept anyway. I mean, the word for the word God, I substituted the word Tao, or T-A-O, the way. But I still nevertheless applied to Tao some of the ideas that you find in theistic religions. A feeling that there should be an attitude of numinousness towards...
An awareness of numinousness. You can't have an attitude of numinousness. You can be you can be aware of the numinousness.
Yes, that's what I mean.
The concept that I try to go back here as far as I could in my childhood and remember how I thought of God then. My impression was then that God's Holy Spirit, and I felt on that. And I just kept those words, and then came ghost, Holy Ghost, breath, breathing, and pure breathing. And I also felt quite peace, uncontaminated breath. And that's what came.
Was that your sort of idea when you were a child?
Yes.
But you see, when you say God is a spirit,
Holy Ghost is the actual word. God, the Holy Ghost.
Do you see a picture in your mind's eye?
No.
Then it is just a set of words.
No, it's a feeling more than a set of words.
What sort of feeling do you get from God is a spirit?
Peace.
Or God is the Holy Ghost?
Peace, the oldness, space, spaciousness, penetrating, and all sorts of aspects.
So you associate it, therefore, with a certain feeling, a feeling of peace, a state of peace.
Yes.
But that is an association, isn't it? Now, tell me, is there any attempt made to come to know God? No. Oh, that's excellent. Because you can't know. You can experience feelings, you can get ideas, you can get thoughts, and all the rest of it.
I think in prison, I listen. Silence or stillness. There's a deep peace which comes at the nearest of them. Can sometimes get.
Yes, there is a feeling of peace, undoubtedly, a state of peace.
And it's sort of waiting. This seems to have that you can't hear. Sit. Do you think the word God in itself is a stumbling block? Because certainly when I was a child, all my associations with religion, organized religion, Sunday school and such, were gloomy and depressing to the extent that I was played truant from Sunday school, for which I was punished if I was caught. Which I think he was. And consequently, the idea of God, one sort of tends to not want to consider the idea of God because of the wrongness of the association.
God was the frustrator.
Well, yes.
The pain bringer.
Yes. At least the sort of
cold stone of churches and the black clothes that the clergy wear and the dismal hymn-tune.
So here we get another side of the coin now presented. In the one case we get this pleasant side, here we get the unpleasant side, the feeling of peace and all the rest of it is the pleasant side. One likes that. So one desires to grab it, to cling to it. Here, because the experience was not pleasant, the tendency is to throw out the source of the displeasure. You see, now, if we can wake up to the reality of what happens in our own mind, we can find freedom. Not by taking this and rejecting that. That way there is no freedom. But by waking up to the fact of what is. Become intensely aware of the what is actually there. Now, Jeff, when you said about the mind being blank with respect to the God idea, but one hears sounds or sees sights far more intensely. That is, of course, quite just what does happen if attention draws nothing out of the particular subject of attention in this case. You see? But might that imply a repressing of the God concept, pushing it out of the mind, pushing it right down into the hidden depths? If so, why? This is what teaches us about ourselves. This is part of the process of self-discovery. Why?
Well, it could be, as Brenda said, in my early days, I had the experience of cheating.
Mm-hmm. There you are, you see. You see, it is not easy to sort of bring these things out. And when we bring these things out, it is not easy, it is very difficult, in fact, to be able to see them for what they actually are. Because the act of seeing, our act of seeing or hearing or touching is already conditioned. Our capacity to see or hear is already a conditioned capacity, which always makes it difficult. This is why it is necessary to be continuously observant and to be observant of the fact that our observation is vitiated all the time. And as we are observant that way, and we see from inside ourselves, so to say, how it is vitiated, and really appreciate the fact that, yes, this is a vitiated observation, one ceases to observe in a vitiated manner. There is a change. The tummy ache is giving place to a comfortable tummy. This is what I am driving at.
What I find terribly difficult to get hold of is the point at which one ceases to observe, and enters into the realm of thought. I mean, this inevitably happens. You are not just a detached observer. You are also thinking about what you are observing. And
yes,
the thought process is conditioned.
Yes.
Conditioned by your...
That's why I said, observe your own reactions. The thought process is your reaction.
mind earlier, aren't you? Because you start thinking, your process of thinking is conditioned, and you finish up.
No, Morris, you're not down a blind alley in this case. You are becoming increasingly cognizant of the whole process. Now, see, take for instance what happens when we are concentrating upon the particular business in hand. You see, it is largely a one-sided thing. It's an extroverted thing mostly. Oh, I've got to do this and I'm doing it. All my attention is gone on to it. I'm not awake to what's going on in my mind reacting to what is being done. You see? But when we awake to the reactions here in one's own brain, as one observes that which is external to oneself, then you become cognizant of the whole situation. See, this is very important. Because that has the full meaning of that comes out only in relation to this. And the full significance of this, which happens inside one's own brain, you see, comes out only in relation to the external thing. The wholeness comes about then in observing, in being aware, in being awake. This is the meaning of being awake. Otherwise it's a one-sided affair. If you may say, well, what's the purpose of it? Because this is the way of understanding. Understanding emerges through this. If understanding doesn't emerge, then one is always in the situation of being in conflict. Always. Whatsoever is neglected in oneself, or whatsoever is neglected outside oneself, which actually is in relation to oneself, you see, all the time, means that there is going to be a conflict. There is no resolution into a harmony. This is the point. If you have four people singing together, one chap stops. Or two or three chaps stop. Well, where are we? The thing's tailed off, isn't it? So now, when we take any of these concepts, when we take any of the big influences which have conditioned us throughout our lives and look at the thing in the sitting quietly by ourselves, we not only look at the thing, but we watch our reaction. See now, as you say, Jeff, in your case, the only reaction was one in which the thing to be looked at went to sleep, so to say, and you were aware of a heightened sense activity, which is very interesting, because the whole thing tells a story about oneself. We don't want to rake up the things which were unpleasant. We like to sort of, you know, indulge in pleasant memories, if things were pleasant and so forth, and exalt them. That way we don't see truth. To see truth means to be aware of the total situation immediately present. And to be aware of it without any blinkers. This is the difficulty. This is a superhuman task. But this is the religious consciousness. When one is awake and aware in that manner, one is wholly understanding, wholly wise, wholly loving. See, you find in the Bible, but Jesus knew with his mind what was in the minds of the people. The Buddha constantly says that he knows with his mind what the other person is, the state of mind of the other person, and so forth. Which means that the truly religious person is completely sensitive. Otherwise, we are incompletely sensitive, and we remain incompletely sensitive as long as all these ideas, beliefs, and the whole lot of them clutter the mind. Because our beliefs are not the unsullied representations of truth. If and when we reach, we have the realization of the truth, we won't be bothered with having any beliefs about it. You don't believe that the sun shines, you know it. It's absolute experience. There is nothing in your experience which will tell you anything to the contrary. Isn't that so? That is knowing the truth. You know the truth, that the sun gives light and heat. There is nothing in your experience to contradict that at all. Then you don't have any beliefs. You don't say, oh, I believe the sun gives light and heat. You know the silly statement? Charmingly silly statement, the moon is a piece of green cheese. Now, I dare say there will be people, children, who might believe that the moon is a piece of green cheese. But you see, the belief has no correspondence whatsoever with the truth. Now this practice of meditation In the truly free way, just observe. That is the free way. Not to bring about any particular result. Results will come inevitably. We can't avoid results. Because that's the nature of the entire universe. Any force brings a result. There we are. So don't bother about the result. Don't be concerned with the result as such. Just observe, keeping the body very, very quiet, and the quietness of the body will help. And see what happens. And gradually, there'll be release. Release from all the binding influences. Any questions about this?
Busy lives make much
Whoever is interested in something and likes to do it, just does it, or attempts to do it, that's all. Put it that way, and I think that's the simplest way to put it. If one is interested in this, well, one naturally does what one can do in relation to it. If one is not interested, one can't do it. It doesn't matter, quite. See, when we ask a question of that type, can we in our busy life do it? What is the implication of that question?
I didn't mean that one can't find time for it, because of course that arrives left to us. I meant that the conditions of life, the way we think, the way we react, all our days, every day, is totally at variance with this. Which I believe
it is at variance with it. And isn't that the reason? Isn't that the reason why there is difficulty, misery, sorrow, frustration, and all the rest of it? Isn't that the reason why we don't really live humanly, fully humanly? This conflicting, confused state of living is not human living. It is partly a question of just how interested we are. How much do we care for it? What we care for, we do. What we don't really care for, we can't do. Unless, it's something technical for which the body is entirely unsuitable. Well, then you can't do it. if a man had only one arm, he can't play a violin. Something like that. Can make some sounds. I know, but still. See, we have arrived at the point where we have seen the theoretical intellectual part of it to the ultimate limit. You see, there is nothing more on the intellectual side. As far as the deepest reality of religion is concerned, the next is the transformation of the individual himself. And here the meditation part comes in. Allow it to happen.
One doesn't necessarily have to sit down in a quiet place, though, to meditate.
Excellent point. One can do it. One can have that sort of alertness, that awakened watchfulness, mindfulness in one's everyday life. That is even more effective in so many ways than setting apart a particular time and place to carry out meditation. But the particular time and place also has its value, provided it is done in the right way. Not in the desirous way of obtaining a good result, of getting to heaven or nirvana or something. Do nothing of the sort. Take any subject you like for next time. coming fortnight. Pick anything whatsoever.
How about nothing at all?
You can't take nothing.
I don't know, we're not expected to have a blank mind at nothing.
It's
the most difficult thing.
No, you never do have a blank mind in that sense, Mrs. Barrett.
No, I suppose
not. No, you see, you don't. You'd have to be totally brainless in order to have that sort of blank mind. As long as there is an actual brain, and a functioning brain, you will always have stuff there. I mean, a good deal of nonsense has been written about this blank mind business, you know.
Yes.
And the empty mind, the emptiness as an absolute blank or an absolute nothingness. That's all absurd and nonsensical. Just doesn't happen.
I think it's stillness, listening, somehow listening.
That means that your brain is very, very active, actually.
Much so. I talk too much. So quickly, because the thing goes through my mind so quickly. I don't like it.
We chose the sublimest subject to start with last time, God. This time choose something quite different. Choose any particular frustration or repression which one has experienced in life. Just look at it.
Through oneself or through other people is the trouble. I think one lacks character for having the courage.
You choose.
You can do.
You choose. They make your own choice. Something which has been most frustrated and hurtful in one's life.
Yes.
Take that. The deepest hurt in one's life. Take the deepest hurt in one's life and work upon it.
What object, wonder, because it really makes you more mad yourself.
What?
Makes one more furious with oneself.
Well, all right, observe the fury. watch, follow that fury, see where it leads. It will reveal the self.
Laziness. Or lack of something. Not laziness, no.
Maybe I'm digressing from the topic, but I think it is related. Even though it is a little wandering off the path. Buddhists very often speak of, what is it, three hindrances to...
Five hindrances, yes.
Or maybe there are three stains, or three impurities. Greed,
hatred,
and
delusion.
What generates this and keeps it going is fear, is it not?
No. We have all these things inborn in us. You see, this thing is derived from the animal world.
Yes.
And it's our heritage. Mm-hmm. It's actually in the very cells, what we call our instinctual actions and this, that, and the other.